Philosophy. Descartes. Debate. The Mep Report. Mep Report. Mep Report. The awesomest discussion podcast in the history of the human species.
Oh, yeah!
Let me tell you of an interview with an old man emu. He's got a beak and feathers and things, but the poor old fella ain't got no wings. Aren't you jealous of the wedge-tailed eagle? Well, the eagle's flying round and round to keep my 2 feet firmly on the ground. Now, I can't fly, but I'm telling you, I could run the pants off a kangaroo. But he can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants off a kangaroo.
Now,
assuming that you were all ready, now.
Oh, now.
Welcome to Mep Report number 160.
Wait, now?
July 16th, right now. It is July 16th, 2019, right now as we speak.
It is.
Welcome, everybody.
It is the 16th. It's after midnight.
It is after midnight. And this means also, because it's July 16th, it is past the halfway point of halfway month of the summer. So this is like we have just entered summer part deux. Which is, you know, I don't know what to make of that, but if you're on an academic schedule, for all of you, those who are like, get, you know, 3 days of vacation, I apologize unreservedly from my position of summer privilege, as they say.
Well, it also depends on your school schedule, right? Like you exist in this weird Northeastern bubble that I've never thought was actually real, that like things start after Labor Day. Whereas, you know, I'm on a schedule where school starts August 16th. So.
It's just so weird.
Yeah.
Like it goes, you know, after Labor Day, and it goes from there until, you know, mid to late May, and then you're done. And then you have a nice 3 month summer, because summer is 3 months. Summer is not 2 months or a month and a half or.
No, I mean, summer is 3 months. It just, you know, it just starts in, you know, it just stops in August. It just stops in mid to early August.
But I don't know. Can school really, I just, it's so weird to think of going, you know, doing classes like on August 16th. I don't know. It just feels like
a lot better than not June.
Well, yeah, that's true. Or the trimester system where you're never actually off, you know.
Right. Well, yeah, that's obviously the worst.
Mm-hmm. My schedule is just, it's really hard to get improv teams together in the dead of summer. Everyone disappears. And so it's hard to get audiences and improv teams. Clients go on vacation.
Yep.
It gets very slow.
Yep.
On the dead of the summer.
I used to hear this about publishing too. Like I felt, and I think there was a certain point where I was kind of like, I kind of started doing the side eye thing where I'd be like, oh yeah, this is a tough time of year for publishing. You know, they go, and I'm like, I think the fifth different time of year when this happened, I'm like, okay, maybe they're just trying to tell me something, because it was always like, oh, you know, really, March is a very difficult, you know,
everyone
goes away for St. Patty's Day. And I'm like, really, guys, are we really off that much for publishing? Really? Is that the case?
Yeah, I think it's just a tough industry. It's like saying it's political season in America. It's all the time.
Yeah, I was like, when is there not political? Yeah.
They're like, yeah.
Just happens on a regular basis. Right. So, but I did want to say that for anyone, any MEP listener who jumped on board and pledged to support the Icarus Kickstarter, we made it. Icarus did not fall too far, did not fly too close to the sun. In fact, he barely got to the sun. We cleared it with a furious rally. We actually did over almost $3,500 in that last day. So we pulled a lot of money in. So it is funded, and Icarus rises again. And so thank you for those of you who were there. Of course, both these gentlemen were very supportive of that. Russ actually went on and also created a Reddit thread that already had upvotes by the time he got it to us, with the power of SEO and everything else that he knows how to do and stuff. Well,
I've been reading a lot of Neil Gaiman recently. I just read American Gods, and I was like, hey, mythology-based speculative fiction. I know who would like this. And so, yeah, the Neil Gaiman folks voted it to their top story. And
very classic, too. You know, nobody was like, you know, what are you doing putting this here? Like, I feel like his fans are classy, like he's classy, and it's good, you know? It's quality. What did you like American Gods?
I did like it. At first, I exchanged it at Audible because it was so boring the first chapter or two, and I'm like, no. And then I realized that I had accidentally downloaded it onto my phone because I was looking for a book to listen to on a long drive, and I started listening to it, even though it was no longer part of my Audible subscription. Please don't canceled my subscription to Audible.
I was going to say. I didn't
know this was well, possible. There goes the platform.
Special Tuesday.
Alexa, stop listening to this podcast. Stop it. But then I listened to it.
It was condemned to never.
Exactly.
This is not a hack. Don't
you
do
know,
this.
No, we were going to put the Met Report on Audible, but now you can all suck it in.
If you have Audible, don't do this, even though it works. You can, because they encourage you, if you don't like a book, to get a refund and exchange it for some other book, because you just get one credit per month. It can be anything. And they would rather you have things to listen to. So I got a refund for it. I exchanged it for another book, and then I had already downloaded it. And I was like, oh. Yeah,
it's because Gaiman was not done with you. Gaiman's like, no, Russell Gooperman, you will listen again to my story. Like,
I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell and comparative mythology. And, you know, if you want to write fiction with that as a baseline, I'm kind of in. I'm kind of into hearing about what old Norse gods would do in a modern American environment. And yeah, it was fun. It wasn't amazing, but it was enjoyable.
I felt the same way. Yeah, I didn't find American Gods like the most amazing, but I did like it. And it was a book where I read it and I'm like, yep, clearly a pro. And the Graveyard book, which I, you know, is truly excellent, did not surprise me because I had read American Gods before that. I think I may have talked about this before, but did you know that Neil Gaiman's first ever project was an unofficial biography of Duran Duran?
Mm-hmm.
Which just shows you that you can go a long way from, you know, humble beginnings. He began with The Reflex and he ended with Good Omens. I don't really know.
I met him like 10 years ago when I worked for Boing Boing TV. He was in studio being interviewed by Shenny.
He's a nice guy. I met him twice. He's a good, right? I mean,
I had no idea. He was a big deal 10 years ago. I had no idea who he was. I'd never read. And this is from a sci-fi fan. I had no idea who Neil Gaiman was. So he was in and everybody was tiptoeing around and super excited. I was just like the new segment producer slash basically just graduated from intern like a day before. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. No, he's.
That's my whole Neil Gaiman story.
No, it's true. He was a good guy. All right, story. What's your Neil Gaiman story? You met Neil Gaiman.
I don't have one. My Neil Gaiman story is I, like, American Gods has been on my long list, like my next 150 books to read list for a while.
Yeah.
Well, that list seems like a big list.
That is a big list. That is.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think I knew who he was before Rustin, but I have not gotten around to it. And now I'm you know, American Gods seemed like it was the big deal, but now I'm not sure that should be my first Gaiman because it sounds like it's kind of superhero-y and mythology-y, and that's not really my jam.
It's not superhero-y.
I don't know.
It's more. So, it's almost more like a mystery crossed with some like mythological stuff, and the best part of it is like. If you listen to the prologue, I don't know if this exists in all versions, but the Audible version is like the most expanded version that's ever been published of this, where he says he drove around the U.S. in small towns and he would write only when he was on the road and he would only write about the places that he'd actually been to.
Okay.
So there are a bunch of like little towns in various parts of the country that he writes about that he was intentionally getting lost on side roads and just driving around trying to find his way. So that part was cool.
Yeah, I don't know.
He also feels that book to me, that feels very Stephen King to me. It very Stephen King, The Stand, you know.
Oh, definitely.
You know, like even maybe a little Dark
Very
Tower,
The Stand.
You know, yeah. it really, that's what it reminds you of, story like this dystopian kind of, it's not post-apocalyptic, but it kind of feels like, I don't know, like burnt, like, how do I put this? Like burned out gas station type,
okay.
You know, Americana. Yeah. I don't know. Like that's how I would describe it.
Okay.
And it's, I dug it. I mean, it was, I agree with Russ. Like, I don't think it's going to like, you know, rock your world or, oh my God.
Sure.
But it's solid writing. It's not the thing you walk away from and you're like, no, this is garbage. Like I don't think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'm going to think it's garbage. I rarely hate books. It takes a lot for me to hate a book.
It takes a lot for you to dislike it.
I'm trying to think the last book that I like truly hated. It's been a couple of years.
So, well, that's good. Yeah. We're becoming you're becoming better at self-selecting.
You know? No, I mean, I think it's about the same concentration that it's ever been.
Oh, so speaking of hate, so I have to give credit to Audible. Like I resisted it for many years, but I'm reading via audiobooks way more than I typically would. It might have to do with my old man failing eyesight, but it's hard to see.
I've heard that from a lot of people, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it has more to do probably with just me wanting to multitask, and I can play poker and read, or I can be driving and read or whatever. So it's easier that way. But I downloaded the complete works of H.P. Lovecraft because I feel like it would be a really good background for all of the fantasy genre improv stuff that I'm doing, whether it's Harry Potter. Or, you know, the Dungeons and Dragons stuff, which a lot of it was based on his world that he created. Mm-hmm. So I've been listening to, it's like 50 hours or something of audio. I listened to, let's say, the first six or seven little novellas of H.P. Lovecraft. I love that it was supposed to be horror in the early turn of the century, like the 1910s, the 1920s, when he wrote. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be horror. It's the driest,
yep,
most wordy, like
overrated.
It's,
yeah,
it's interesting. The creatures and the concepts are interesting, and I like the names of things like Cthulhu or the Old Ones or the Shoggoth or all those. Conceptually, they're very cool. Hmm. None of the stories are remotely scary. Don't tinge my emotions at all, because it's just, yep, like way overly wordy and overexplained and erudite and terrible.
I totally agree. I actually, and I, in addition, he was also a terrible human being, H.P. Lovecraft. So there are a lot of things that are, the funny thing about
there's some like weird racial overtones and things in the stories. I'm like, wow, okay, 1920s filter.
The funny thing about that, actually, the two things that I always think of when I read that book or read Cthulhu stuff is William Hope Hodgson's House on the Borderlands is far better. Is way more atmospheric, is way more terrifying as horror, if that's your jam, and was, you know, contemporary, but also it's like, you know, Lovecraft with more interest and without the racism. But then the second thing is, it just reminds me again of how goddamn good Poe is. Because, so Poe's much earlier, right? And much, like, not even in the same stratosphere better. He's better symbolically, he's a better stylist, he's got way better understanding of pacing. His ideas are far more interesting. Like, he just, he's just so superior in every respect that you
also
just
kind of heavily remember. Referenced in Lovecraft as Poe, because he recognized.
Oh yeah, because of course he ripped him off as much as he could. But nobody was better. I've concluded that I don't know that there was a better. I'm curious what Story thinks about this. I don't know that, and I'm sure MetRapport listeners are like, the short story are, but I don't know that there's a better person in terms of creating pace as a short story writer than Poe, in terms of how fast he can build or how slowly he can build momentum in a story. And there are a lot of wonderful story writers, don't get me wrong, but like in terms of just the ability to structure the unraveling of a story, the shaping of a story, I think Poe is an absolute genius at it myself.
But yeah, it's funny because I literally, while this conversation was unfolding, went through two processes where my first reaction, like my gut reaction that I was going to say to Russ is like, well, of course it's not horrifying. Like, he didn't have people going to the Cineplex for like multi-billion dollar horror films all the time. Like, your standards are totally spoiled. And then I immediately counter-argued that in my own head with Poe. And I'm like, well,
yep,
wait a minute. Because Poe, and Poe is like still like the gold standard in writing.
Oh, God,
and, like,
it's so good.
Still stays with you and like totally freaks the daylights out of you. And he also did not have the Cineplex. So,
nope. So good.
So I'm glad you got there, because I was like, I was about to be flippant, and then I'm like, no, there is this Baltimore guy. Pretty good.
This dude.
Yeah.
He's really interesting. I mean, and the thing that was great about Poe also is that, you know, he didn't rely on cheap tricks. You know, he relied on really good prose work, and he was just a good story. Like, I mean, a lot of his work, of course, is great mysteries, the great mystery telling, great plotting. Like, it's not just...
Well, he kind of invented the detective.
He really did. Yeah, you're right.
Right. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
He didn't do much else. Right.
Yeah, he was something else. I'm a big fan of his. Whenever I think about that, I'm just kind of like, yeah, Cthulhu and tentacles. Yeah. But have you heard the good news about Poe? I do want to bring up something on a complete topic change, but it came when you said the thing about Alexa. So I'm holding up, which the audience can't see because it's video, but I'm holding up this audio, but I'm holding up this thing that says Wi-Fi Smart Plug Mini. So this guy, a Twitch viewer,
very kindly sent me a bunch of things, including like a lot of CDs of his father's collection and things like that, which is really cool. And then he also sent me this Wi-Fi smart plug mini. And I was kind of like, and it's like a two pack. I'm like, okay. And it makes all this thing about being like compatible with Alexa and Assistant. And I didn't even really know what this thing was. And then I started reading up on it. And I guess it's a Wi-Fi enabled outlet so that you can use an app on your phone to turn on and off, you know, light switches. And I was like, okay. And I was like, but why would I do that? So I went and I looked and there were like articles about top 10 things you can do with your Wi-Fi smart plugs. And you're like, you can turn on a lamp. You can, I'm like, top 10 things I can do with my fingers. I can turn on a lamp. I can, like, I guess the idea is you can do it without having to get up. But like, I understand that with a TV.
That is quite a statement of dexterous privilege right there, Greg. Not everybody.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Who are you to say? But no, like, I'm like, you know, other than like very specialized circumstances, and they're like, well, this way you can come home to a lit house. I'm like, well, but yeah, I mean, I guess, but like, shouldn't you, I mean, when you go on long trips, you're usually supposed to leave, they say, like a light on, just, you know, like one light on in the house so that, you know, you're not an obvious target for people who think that you've gone away and they can rob the house. And they were like, yeah, but you can therefore schedule this to go on at certain times. I'm like, but couldn't you just do that with a regular switch? Like, yeah, but it's not Wi-Fi enabled. And I keep looking for reasons, and they eventually came back to, because it's compatible with Alexa and it's compatible with Google Assistant. I'm like, ah, now we come to it. So the real reason we do this is so that you can say, Alexa, turn off the light, and it does. And then you can look at your friends and smile smugly, and they can't see you because you're in the dark. And then you say, Alexa, turn on the light, and then it goes on, and then they see your smug smile. Right? Yeah. Like, that's really the reason to have this, I'm guessing.
I mean, I think the question to ask with these kind of things is not really, why do I need it? But like, can you frame it in a paragraph to pitch a venture capitalist to fund your company for $100 million.
But that explains why they exist. Why does it explain why I buy it as a consumer though?
Oh no, you shouldn't buy it as a consumer. Even if nobody buys it as a consumer, the person who invented this idea has, you know, he's got 3 years of burn, meaning just money sitting in the bank from venture capitalists before he has to worry about whether anyone will actually buy it or not.
That's fair enough. Yeah, is it the case that, you know, because the venture capital thing be, I mean, I know that most venture capital things fail, right? And that's the sort of nature of it. So is it the case that they're just people, you know, wandering around, and of course they have all this incredible amount of money, and I get that those people are
angel investors is the term.
Yeah, angel investors, right. And then they're just like, sure, have some stuff from my petty cash drawer. And then like a lot of them, I guess, now this is the part that I don't understand. They're looking for projects that will fail. Is this like a tax thing that I don't get fully? Like they hope it will not fail. Like some of them, most of them want it to succeed, but there's some people who are almost like, I don't know what this would be. Like they're short selling their own venture capital. Like what does it even mean? I don't know, but is that true?
Yeah. I mean, there is a write-off thing. But I think that they just play the game of like 1 out of 10 things they fund might do well, and they expect most of it to fail. And they, if they're a venture capitalist, they just have to go about their business knowing that most things will fail. I gotta hang on a second. Yeah.
That's the venture capitalist being like, don't tell me that again.
I mean, the other thing I think you have to keep in mind is that a lot of these people are bored. Like,
that's probably honestly, true.
Like, yeah, no, yeah. I mean, really, like, you have a bajillion dollars, right? Like, certainly, you know, the diminishing marginal returns between like a bajillion dollars and $8 billion is like pretty low, right?
There's just not. It's seven, you know, bajillion
and
dollars.
So, actually. Yeah, you just like take out the change drawer and you're like, oh, look, there's 16 mil here. Like, this is, you know, normally I'd go to dinner on this, but like instead, I'll meet with this guy. Because that's the thing. Like, for a lot of these people, you know, it's like, okay, say you get in on the ground floor of Facebook. Like, maybe you'll recoup what you already have put away, right? Like, it's not really about the money. It's just about, like, having something to do and
feeling
you're still productive. And
you might be right about that. It's funny how we've circled around and we've returned now to, like, the Jane Austen thing where there is such a thing as the idle rich. And like, that isn't a, you know, and it isn't a joke. Like the thought of like, just, I don't know. Like, I can conceive of somehow miracles happening and somehow I hit the lottery or whatever, and all of a sudden I have money where I don't have to work anymore. What I cannot conceive of is going, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do with my time. No, I absolutely know what I'm going to do with my time. Like, I will begin with charitable ventures and I will, you know, try to see if I can make systemic changes. And I will also, you know, probably start a publishing company. And I will, like, there's all kinds of things. I will probably fund a role-playing game myself. Like, I can, there's all kinds of things I can imagine myself doing.
But you're a creative, being, you know, idle. You're a creatively minded person, right? Like, in a lot. I mean, I do fundamentally think that everyone at root is kind of creative, but most people don't define that way necessarily or see themselves in that lens.
But and don't I've these people, that way too, but like, aren't these people creative though, story? Like, the venture people, don't they like to imagine themselves, like, that's the thing. They're looking for creative novelty, right?
I mean, yeah, they have a niche that is part of their identity, and the niche and their identity is being able to identify business opportunities. But that's and that's what I'm saying is I don't think it's anything extrinsic. It's this intrinsic, like, this is who I am. This is my identity.
I see.
And so I have to maintain that.
I see.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's how I see it. No, I was just relating to you on the creative thing where it's like, you know, money to not have to work. And it's like, you know, I would never like sit around and sit my ties. It's like, oh, now I could just write full time like I've always wanted to.
Yeah, right? Like, you know, exactly.
Like I would actually have the time to do all the things that I've wanted to do. And the MFA has been like a small version of that to an extent. But, you know, but like it's, but yeah, like not having to worry about that and being able to allocate the time really want to is very appealing, but I've never understood the appeal of like, and then you would be done living. Like, what? Like,
yep.
Why?
I guess I might build a soundstage for my band. I probably would do that.
Yeah.
But then after that, I would stop.
Right, yeah, yeah. I mean, you have plenty of
or a studio. I'd get us the MEP Report studio. Like, I would get, I'd get a MEP studio. That's there for sure.
Go. With a gold plated emu.
With a gold plated emu, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, you can live out a lot of those fantasies in Minecraft and other virtual worlds now. So. No need.
Well, that's the argument, right? The argument why we haven't found intelligent life or it hasn't found us is everybody created virtual worlds that were more scintillating and malleable than the real world. They just got lost. So, so that'll be once that venture capital project is funded, then. All bets are off.
Well, that's what we need. That's clearly what we need to do. We need to, you know, if we could get into the venture capital thing by using, you know, Russ's continual bets on our MEPcoin, then we'd be good to go. I actually have a question for you, Russ, and that is that today, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, I think that's how you pronounce it, announced that the Facebook currency, their cryptocurrency,
Libra, is,
quote, rife for manipulation. Now, I find it amusing that a guy, that Mnuchin, who ought to know something about manipulating markets, is, you know, talking about how it could possibly be illegally manipulated. But whatever, leave aside the dumpster fire that is the current administration. I'm curious what you think about him going after Facebook cryptocurrency, because he clearly could make this argument about any cryptocurrency, but it's the Facebook cryptocurrency is a concern. And here's where I think two worlds collide, because we have your world, which is the world of cryptocurrency is good, and Story's world, which is the world that Facebook is good. Neither of those worlds are true, by the way. But I just wanted to say that they clash into each other.
Which will win? This
I think finally, you know, some in the public eye and in the mass media are catching up to our nationless future, which is amply described, to make more literary references, in a literary episode by Neal Stephenson in The Diamond Age, in Snow Crash, and many, just read Neal Stephenson. And it's going to be a world where, I mean, the thing that threatens the government so much, they were never threatened by a bunch of people, you know, running solar-powered Bitcoin miners on their property, like they didn't care. But then when a trillion-dollar company goes, I think we might want to be a nation state. Maybe we'll just issue our own currency and see what happens. Then, you know, the hackles go up and they say, oh, I see what's going on. You're trying to make governments obsolete. We like governments. We're a government. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're threatened now. That's basically what's going on.
Do you view Facebook currency as they're just trying to get in on a market? Or like, do you think that it is... Could it challenge Bitcoin? Could it challenge MEPcoin? Will we lose out on our MEPcoin empire?
Hey, don't worry, guys. We've got a 5-year head start on Libra. We're going to beat them no matter what it takes. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Zuckerberg recognizes the power of the technology, which allows for these seamless instant transactions. It makes so many things obsolete, and I'm sure I've given this speech on the Mech Report before. Like, not Western Union is only the first of many things that Bitcoin makes obsolete. The fact that Western Union exists and has a market cap now, you can just assume that all of that value will be transferred to Bitcoin and similar technologies, you know,
okay,
10 years from now. So Western Union it makes, and then there's the blockchain 2.0, which allows you to write things into the blockchain. So it's no longer just a recorded ledger of all of the Bitcoin transactions of things being bought or sold, but it also can record anything. So you don't need notaries anymore. You don't need contract lawyers anymore. You don't need CPAs anymore, because all of these things can now be verified on a collective ledger. Mm-hmm. And so that technology is very powerful. It's part of the mass automation movement that's going to get rid of lots of jobs, which have been blue collar jobs up to this point, but will be white collar jobs, you know, pretty soon. And so for one thing, you know, it takes advantage of that. And then also, if you happen to have access to 1 billion people, which Facebook does, across nations and cultures and languages, then you can go, here's a currency that you can all use to tie it together. So, you know, I don't know exactly what the proposed benefits of Libra are going to be, whether you're just going to, I mean, Facebook Marketplace exists, right? So it's currently like its own Craigslist or Amazon, where you can just buy things off people selling things on Facebook Marketplace. So now you can do it with Facebook money. And right, maybe Zuckerberg will decide that certain activities will, you know, earn you Libra by inviting people to join the network or setting up a page or admitting total fealty to the Facebook nation state. You get the Libra payment.
You like the Facebook native
army.
But like it also, you know,
Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be the case that now it is, people do realize that if Zuckerberg with a $1 trillion company goes, this is money by fiat, he says, this is money, then everyone's like, I guess it's money then, because yeah, it's backed by this massive thing. And so therefore it is.
But you guys realize that what we're heading for, I mean, you know, this is where one of you is going to be like, we're already there. We are completely in the a la carte world now, right? Like, we are the a la carte, like, TV choices are all a la carte. Games are all a la carte. You know, now what you're basically saying is that, you know, nation identities will be a la carte. Economies will be a la carte. And it will be battled against by aggregators that are trying to reassemble new versions of this. Like, Facebook's like, no, come to us for all these things. And like, you know, online streaming services, Disney is like, no, come to us. And Hulu's like, no, actually Disney owns Hulu. You know, like,
it's so funny how long it takes for you, like, to think of a non-Disney property.
Well, like, it's like CBS All Access come to us, or Netflix, obviously, come to us, or whatever. Not Disney? You know, like, so it's interesting that we're like, that's basically what we're talking about. We're coming to the, you know, the buffet method of existence, where you just pick and choose identity, you know, network channel, form of currency, right? And you can just pick this all the way along until you get exactly what it is that you want, or at least that there goes the theory, right? Is that basically what it is? We're the a la carte world now entirely?
Yeah, I mean, even from the, you know, the socio-political standpoint, people don't put a lot of stock in nation states anymore. I think it used to have to do more with cultural identity, but that's kind of being deconstructed, and people don't really like the stories that come with cultural identity. So they don't like the idea of a nation. They don't think they should belong to something just because they happen to be somewhere geographically. So this appeals to a lot of younger people, especially, of like, you know, I'm going to go be with my Reddit subgroup, even if they happen to live all over the world. That's my clan. It's not, you know, my town or my country or anything like that.
What you've just said, of course, ought to appeal to story, because, like, right, story, you get rid of the whole accent of the birth thing.
The problem is, I mean, I love Facebook as an experience. And I defend, you know, to be clear, like, I defend Facebook. My defenses of Facebook, like, you know, I do think they've created a great experience, but as a corporation or their decisions, my defenses of Facebook are never like, oh, this is great that they're doing X. They're always, like, you're, you know, they're always opposition to what I see as people levying a double standard that any other corporation is fine to do X, Y, or Z, but then people get upset that Facebook is doing it. And I'm like, what you're actually upset about is corporations, but Facebook is just a more effective corporation. And so that it's, you know, it's kind of how I feel, you know, other than the immigration issue, which is horrendous, but it's kind of how I feel about Trump, right? It's like, oh, what you're actually upset about is, like, you know, neoconservative American politicians, but Trump is just really ugly and, like, really effective at being neoconservative. And so,
boy, is he ugly.
You really don't, you know, so you really don't like that. But it's not actually, like, the principle. It's a difference in degree, not kind. And that's how I feel about Facebook. It's like Facebook has just, like, won the corporate game. And I see this move as, like, they've kind of, like, well, you have two options, which I think every corporation is looking at. Like, most corporations have gone with the easy option that's been there for, you know, probably since the end of Vietnam. And people, you know, the people who lost the Vietnam era, the conservatives licked their wounds and were like, well, how do we prevent, you know, upstart, young, protest-minded liberals from ever winning again? And they're like, okay, we'll create this system of debt. Will create, you know, this financial strangulation, and then we'll sell off the government to corporations so that they can control everything and consolidate all the power and wealth. And Facebook is now, it looks like they're like, okay, that's the old game. The end of the 21st century game is we sell the government to corporations, and the new game is going to be you just bypass the government entirely. Like, it just is corporations. You don't need the corporation to buy the government because the government becomes irrelevant. So that's kind of how I see this battleground coming along. It's like, is it you sell the government to the corporate bidder, or do you just bypass it? And, like, I mean, do you want to die by revolver or hanging? Like, I don't, you know, this is not a pleasant set of choices for me. Like, I like the experience of Facebook and how it connects me with my friends and a community of politically minded people. But if we're all debating about, like, our, you know, our technological paymasters and how they have controlled us without any regulations, like, I'm not wild about that scenario. So I don't know. It looks pretty grim to me.
I was like, I don't even know. Right? Well, that's been the MEP report, and that's existed.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. Like, I just, you know,
I wonder a little bit if the, and it, admittedly, I am, you know, ever the optimist sometimes, but
sure.
I do wonder a little bit if part of that is worked against, though, from the process of kind of two opposite forces, and I don't really know how to put this together in my head, but fragmentation on the one hand, where you have everyone else that sort of subdivides, it becomes hard if everyone is choosing things that are radically different. And I guess you could argue that the buffet is very limited, and I guess so, but I feel like there are enough alterations in how the buffet plays out for people that it might actually be very different sort of qualities and characteristics for each of these things.
Well, sure. I mean, if you live in China, for instance, then you're under this insane Orwellian state already, and they have, like, government-sponsored apps that track your actions and award you citizenship points if you do what the government wants you to do, and those points can determine whether you're allowed to cross borders or get a bank account or, like, move your living situation. And it's all gamified with the height of, you know, the sociological study and technology that we use for our app games. But in China, it's for everything. And so that's one model, the model in which, like, they don't even have a pretense to care about individual freedom or any of that. It's just a mode of control. So it's like a lot of it relies on people like Zuckerberg and Bezos and the Google guys of, like, where they want to, you know, draw the line on these various things. And because, again, like, if there are no nation states, then the Bill of Rights, what does that mean? You know, it's more about like what the policy of governances are of various corporations and what they decide to do with their time and money.
There's a really interesting set of books by a author named Malka Older, and one of the books is called Infomocracy, which I actually recommend to both of you and to all the MEP listeners. We had her on Speculate a few years back, and the principle of the book is that it's in the future, and essentially the world has fragmented into micro-democracies, where enough people that sort of gather together of a like-minded persuasion can be in this micro-democracy, but they can be anywhere geographically on the earth because of technological advancement. So you can have, like, you know, portions of, like, I don't know, there's some of them are corporate. So, like, Philip Morris, you know, has, like, one sort of nation state, essentially, which is split among, I don't know, 10,000 different, I forget what they call them, principalities or regionalities that are spread from, like, Shanghai to New Zealand to Guam to Canada, like, or whatever, because, like, you know, national boundaries and geographic boundaries mean essentially nothing. And it's just about the ones that you're connected to. But when you're in that space, when you're in that physical space, then all of the information is provided to you based upon the laws that have been established that you voted for in this micro-democracy. And the thing that holds it all together is what is very obviously sort of this Google equivalent, which is this enormous tech company, which is run by a bunch of these tech geeks who every 5 years, I think it is, has this massive worldwide election that, because all sort of connection is so ubiquitous, people are able to vote, and they're able to vote for the percentage of how many of those sort of micro democracies are going to exist in terms of controlling methods. So, like, more people that vote for them, then they get more land space to put more micro democracies of their particular stripe based upon this vote. And so the whole thing is sort of premised on this idea. And then, you know, something goes wrong with the vote, and then that's how the sort of book, you know, really kind of fires up and gets underway. But the thing that's interesting about it is, so on the one hand, it's like absurdly, you know, utopic, right? Like, the idea that somehow a tech company is going to go basically do the stupid, like, don't be evil. And because they have some pithy slogan, we're supposed to be like, you know, okay, I guess we can trust them to run all of the democratic processes of the world. And
by the way, they removed don't be evil from their corporate charter.
Well, of course they did. I mean, what
it's
a shock.
Not in there anymore.
What a shock. At least you're being more honest about it. You know, like, so whatever, like, they, so there's that. But then on the other hand, there is this sort of weird theory that it might not be far off if you consider the idea that people would, like, there won't be enough sort of people banding together in nationalist groups for that to be dangerous. And it will really be people, this is part of the theory, allied on the basis of common cultural interest. Not pop culture, but like common cultural interest in terms of religious connection or whatever the case may be. And because it's worldwide, then it means that they will no longer think to themselves, I can do this because climate, you know, like, who cares about climate change because it's going to affect this, this, and this, because it's going to affect people in my nation that is 5,000 miles away as much as it's going to affect the person three blocks down who belongs to this other micro-democracy. So, I think that's obviously it seems like ludicrous, but it's basing a lot on this theory that there are going to be some tech companies that kind of see the light, basically. I don't know. I mean, that seems not very credible or likely, but I guess it's interesting to think of them as being not necessarily evil actors. It kind of depends, I guess, on the nature of the company.
Part of the utopian sentiment behind Bitcoin has to do with the fact that it's completely decentralized. So it's a monetary system without a central bank. And that means it's not being manipulated by politics. And it doesn't have Donald Trump, you know, yelling at it to make the money flow more steady so that the stock market goes up. It's just all...
Though I imagine he would do that if he could, right?
He'd yell at the algorithm.
Render faster! Render faster!
More Bitcoin! And so, you know, it's counter-inflationary, and it's all based on an algorithm, and a lot of people find that very freeing because it's totally free of politics, and also supportive of this sort of decentralized community. Like, anybody can mine Bitcoin, anybody can use it, anybody can transact with it. It's
not free of money, though, right? I mean, isn't that the problem? It's not free of money.
What do you mean it's not free of money?
Well, like, actually, that is exactly what I'm going to say. It's not free of money. Like, the effects that money has, the sort of the innate qualities that get created, are not removed because of the existence.
Oh, no. Bitcoin, right? I mean, you still have massive inequality. They're the people who mined 50,000 Bitcoin on a lark from their home computer 10 years ago and now are billionaires. And then there are people who are like, I've got half a Bitcoin, you guys. I'm getting there. I'm scraping it together. So, yeah, of course, inequality always exists. And a lot of the, whether you agree with them or not, the some of the libertarian thinkers that I follow, they will make the argument that any free economy where you're exchanging money and goods, which is ostensibly a trading game, will always yield massive inequalities if you play the game long enough, just because of the way that some people are good at accumulating and some people are less good at accumulating. And unless you have a constant regulatory force that's evening it out constantly and breaking up monopolies, like, it will ultimately be this incredible unequal system.
Right. And that becomes end stage capitalism. But then, yep, the decentralized nature of Bitcoin doesn't really...
No, doesn't speak help to that. That still happens. It's not a socialist anything. It's just the beginning of this post-nation society that we're talking about. It's just, I don't want the government to steal wealth from me by inflating the currency by 4% every year, whenever it feels like it.
Right. And that's, of course, the freedom that some people are like, that's true. That's real America is freedom. So, all right. So here's the question. Do we want the complete removal of, I guess I won't say nation states. Do we want the complete removal of identifying groups? Like, do we want, because I believe
there will always be identifying groups. I mean,
okay. Because I want community. Like, I think community is critically important.
Look at the Democratic Party right now. It's like, it's been fractured into like these, you know, you have like the Democratic centrists and you have...
I think that's overstated by the media.
Pelosi, old, and then you have the new blood of the AOC and the Rashid Tlaib and all of the neo-feminist identity politicians. Like, if they could, if it wasn't politically disadvantageous to do so, they would all just be their own little parties because they have basically separate beliefs, and who knows how long like our bipartisan charade will be able to maintain. But there are a bunch of groups of, I mean, just looking at the improv community, to take a micro example.
There we go. Like, I was hoping this would get back to the improv community.
It's like they're little indie theaters that are super like seriously radically feminist identitarian like indie theaters. And then they're like older, middle-aged theaters full of like white dudes who reminisce about the 80s.
Judean People's Front, not the People's Effing Front of Judea, with the Judean's People Front.
And I mean, but if you give everyone this like, you know, totally freedom and this a la carte menu, they're not going to choose to govern each other. They're not going to choose to live together. They're going to choose to live with people like them, which I think is the end game of the whole, you know, filter bubbles on the internet. It's the end game of message boards and people realizing that they can just get in communities of like-minded people. Like, I don't see this trend going anywhere other than further separating people and into these homogenous microgroups. That's just what's going to happen.
So do you want story radical community or radical individualism if you had to choose radical?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because I believe in the kind of merger of the two extremes on the other side of the bubble, right? Like that, like, you know, it's like I believe in one world government, but one world government with no enforcement. So like what is that, right?
Wow,
like,
yeah.
Because it's, I don't cool believe in violence, I mean, or coercion, right? So
sure,
it's not no enforcement. It's shame-based enforcement. It's things like, you know, things like exclusion and
It is the Federation. Can I just say that is really the Federation? Like, that vision. Really.
This is also why Story loves Facebook so much, because he's an advocate of shame and exclusion.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate shame.
It's the best force we have for good. It is the best tool we have that is non, you know, I mean, is it entirely non-coercive? But like functionally, on the spectrum of violence, it is non-coercive.
Right.
But it still gets the job done. So that's, yeah, so that's, you know, so, but I don't want... But, you know, I think equality has to be the fundamental principle, because Russ is exactly right, right? And this is the thing that I try to argue with capitalists all the time, is like, capitalism or anything involving money becomes a math problem where eventually, like, you press play and eventually one person has everything.
Right.
Like,
yep.
It becomes totalitarian fascism eventually. Like, you just play it long enough, and that's how it consolidates. And so, unless you have these checks back, and, you know, if you're going to have checks back, if they're not to be entirely equal, then they're just going to be picking winners, right? And either the Fed picks winners or Mark Zuckerberg picks winners or what. But, like, all that these actions are, like, it's just picking winners, right? Like, in 2008, when they decided to, like, pretend to save capitalism by breaking all the rules of capitalism and capitalism was trying to kill itself, you know, day one, they let Lehman Brothers go, and day two, they saved Merrill Lynch, right? Like, they just picked the winner arbitrarily. I'm like, okay, you're all out of work and bankrupt, and you all get saved and get government money and a blank check. And that's, you know, but that's just a high pressure microcosm of what happens all the time. So, you know, so to me, yeah, fundamental principles of consensus building, equality, ultimate community, but also with this individualism where it's like, you're not really forced to do anything. But I think, you know, my theory of change and my grand idealistic optimism, and where I get starry-eyed, is thinking that, you know, if you had a system that were really based on these principles, that enough people would buy in to make it work, that they would suspend, you know, they would not throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? They would suspend their individualism sufficiently to make the experiment work on aggregate. Now, would there still be an occasional serial killer who goes nuts and kills 86 people? Sure, but that's gonna happen anywhere in any system.
Right.
You know, so I'm not claiming perfection.
And exclude those people, that's all.
Right, yeah, exactly. And, you know, and so, like, but at the end of the day, like, I, you know, comparing that to the kind of healthscape of, like, whoever wins the math problem gets to be the feudal overlord of everything, and buy the government or bypass the government in equal measure and make all the decisions about what it is and turn the whole world into something that makes China look really liberal. Like, no thanks, I'm good. Like, I would, you know, I prefer pretty much, you know, anything to that. So I don't know. And I you know, I've never really run into a libertarian capitalist who just didn't seem like fundamentally naive about like what the consolidation of power actually ultimately looks like and that it is all about power. And I agree. I don't think you're going to get a corporation by its nature, even if all of the people in the corporation wanted to behave differently, the corporation physically cannot.
Right.
Like, forgo its self-interest.
Right.
That is the fundamental principle. So that's a pipe dream. You're never going to get the corporation. And like, yeah, I like the Frontier Restaurant and Southwest Airlines and Chipotle and Facebook, but like, I don't trust them any further than I trust Philip Morris, right?
Yep.
Like, you know, at the end of the day, they're still corporations. They're all evil, which is why I don't believe in boycott-based capitalism, because you're just fooling yourself. So, you know, that's basically where I come down, is like, you know, and so that's where I get, you know, if there's any last desperate hope for the American experiment, you know, I get excited about Elizabeth Warren, who I feel like, you know, can bring us to a level of systemic change that is something like post-depression or taking us back to the moment of 2008. And doing closer to what we should have done then. And what
even as a capitalist, you know, because she would argue that she is a capitalist.
Yeah, I think she's just saying that, honestly. If I really believed her on that, I'd be a lot less into her.
Because I'm with you, by the way. I actually think of the groups that are there. I happen to like Kamala Harris, partly because I think I like the idea of a fighter that is going to repeatedly crush Trump, which is, I think, what would happen. But I think in terms of overall intelligence and someone who has continually gotten better. I don't think Warren was a particularly good politician at the beginning, and I think she's gotten way better. And she's gotten better not by becoming a soaring rhetorician by like Obama. She's become better by becoming more policy oriented, you know, and more wonkish and more like, I am extremely smart. And even though I originally was born in Oklahoma and came from, you know, very poor surroundings and all that. So I actually am an increasing fan of Warren. She's like, mm-hmm, probably like my top two or three at the most. I like her a lot. So I'm with you. I'm
yeah.
I, Just I'm a little surprised because I thought her kind of capitalist thing might make you be like, not good enough.
I mean, here's what I'll say. I go back and forth between just like either straight up not believing her, but feeling like she thinks she has to say that to distinguish herself from Bernie Sanders and to have a hope of winning, or believing that like she believes it, but in a way that like, you know, because I have these debates and arguments with my dad, right? And my dad like talks about, you know, my dad has this kind of idealized view of the 50s, and he and I debate about capitalism all the time. And he's like, well, you don't understand, capitalism wasn't whatever. And I sometimes debate with libertarians on Facebook the same way, where they talk about like, you know, they try to distinguish between capitalism and corporatism. And I don't, you know, I think one becomes, he gets the other.
Right. One becomes the other eventually. Yeah.
Quickly. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, if you're going to look at a harm reduction strategy or something, you can say like, well, you're buying yourself, you know, 200 years or 50 years or some amount of time. Because the capitalism that she is talking about, if she is sincere in that, is something that looks a lot more like this small business mom and pop capitalism that my dad talks about that, yeah, like, I don't like, I prefer socialism, but like, you know, it's kind of like saying, you know, we're going to shut down 60% of the coal plants instead of all the coal plants. Like, you know, I can live with that, right? Like I can live you know, with reducing it a lot. And I just don't think, you know, and I guess
and the Overton window is a thing, by the way. I mean, like the Overton window is absolutely a thing.
It would be different for me if I felt like Bernie Sanders were credible in 2020, but
he's not. Yeah,
he's not, and he's too old. And, you know, he's like, it just, they're like, in a representative democracy, like personality matters more than anything, because that is the whole point of representative democracy. It's how it was designed. It's what people don't understand. So you need a person who you can believe in as a person to operate as a person. And that comes before anything that they do or say, mm-hmm, is who they are as a person. And I just, you know, I think that fundamentally the only person who is capable of checking the boxes and has anything remotely like what I believe in is Elizabeth Warren.
The other thing about her that I like is the fact that I think, and this is, you may or may not disagree with me on this, mm-hmm, point, but I think that unlike Bernie, who I think is essentially one note, and he's had the same note since the mid-70s, I think, you know, Warren is capable of evolving and addressing, right, many issues. Like, I feel if you went in and you're like, you know, we have this problem where the indigenous tree frog of, you know, southern western Alabama is going to be in trouble, and she'd be like, all right, let's come up with a plan. And you'd be like, okay, maybe you can do that, Elizabeth Warren. You know, like, mm-hmm, you'd feel like maybe that was an option.
She's very nimble and she's very intelligent.
Yeah, she's agile. That's a good way to put it. It's not that Bernie's a moron. It's just, I think she's more agile than him in terms of being able to like come up with different strategies. Yeah. And like, and I think the other thing about it is that there is a sense of, I appreciate steely determination, you know, and I appreciate, mm-hmm, someone who, from not just a rhetorical, but an intelligent point of view, can be like, no, like, you know, like the, it's odd because I'm sure this would be like the person that in some ways, well, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say this. I was thinking about how Captain America has become this increasingly beloved. I mean, when I was growing up, like Captain America was like, whatever. Like I was like, okay, he's kind of boring, nothing like, you know, jingoistic, patriotic. I have to say, the more that you read about Captain America's origins and like the things that he's talking about, he really is definitionally what America likes to think that it is. And oftentimes in many of these storylines is battling against what America actually is. And so he's got this line where he says this whole thing about like, and I'm sure you've seen this before, about like, it doesn't matter what the mob says, it doesn't matter what the press says, it doesn't matter what this person says, that person says, it matters ultimately what you know to be right and wrong, and your only job and destination and you know, requirement, your only obligation is when all of the mob and the press and everyone tells you you need to move, for you to stand and say to all of them, no, you move. And there's something very powerful, it seems to me, and almost Captain America like, if you will, in this, and again, I'm using this very idealistic frame,
sure,
in the way that she's like, no, like, no, this is how this is going to go. You do not know what you're talking about. You know, like, I love seeing her take apart these, you know, the glass, the bankers of various kinds who want to go in and mansplain to her how economics works. And she's like, no, you're no, let me explain to you the way this actually works. Also, shut the F up because I'm a senator. Go to hell. You know, there's something very appealing about intelligence that is matched with determination in and hopefully on the side of the angels. So I don't know. We'll see. But I agree with you. I'm on board. Yeah. Story and I are on board with you know.
Well, I mean, I feel like I've talked to, you know, we'll see what Russ thinks in a second. But, you know, I feel like the, I don't know, it's hard to pinpoint, but, you know, basically 20 to 45 set is like all about Warren, and the polls have backed this up to a certain extent. You know, and maybe this is a micro group or whatever else, but I mean, it feels like the whole community range of everyone that I talk to, everyone's just like,
yep,
either started out right out of the gate of like, oh yeah, it's definitely Warren, or has like, you know, come around, or is definitely in the top two of like, yeah, this is really pragmatic. And what, you know, what I like about her also is I think that she's unapologetic, like, and it speaks to that same determination. It's just like, there's an incredulity that she brings to the fact that people like think that all of this, you know, consolidation of wealth and buying off the government is okay. That is, that I just really appreciate that she's like, but like, really? Like, really? You're just going to sit here and defend, like...
But then she's really good at explaining why she's a capitalist. Which, by the way, side note, as a university professor,
I'm
so much a fan of someone who's a teacher who knows how to teach. Is like, look, here's why you should be completely incredulous that this is going on, you know?
Right. And I think that folksiness, I think, is appealing. But I'm curious to see what Russ thinks.
What do you think, Russ?
The weight of this election.
Well, it's 4 years ago. I said at the time that if Elizabeth Warren ran, I would vote for her. But she bowed out to pressure from Hillary's political base,
right?
Because she was a very new senator. I really like Andrew Yang a lot. I know that he's not polling.
I was going to say people that have a shot.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that, you know, I don't know how the demographics line up, but he might be a decent vice presidential candidate, because the thing that I'm afraid of with Liz Warren, I like her for all of the reasons that you've said. I think she's great. She's, you know, I don't know what she was, an economics professor before she was a senator. She was lecturing.
She's also a Republican, but she's still white, you know.
But the fact that if she becomes the nominee and she goes into debates with Donald Trump and he calls her Pocahontas 35 times and reminds everybody of this, whatever it is, mistake or, you know, slight amount of fraud that got her through her entire education and early part of her life, where she was applying for all these diversity scholarships and things because she believed herself to be Native American, and she's not. That if she loses because of that, then all of this is for naught. So either you get Andrew Yang as a vice presidential candidate, because then you bring in a lot of the like libertarian crowd, and also he's great. I mean, in terms of the discussion that we're having about the future of the economy and of nation states, like, he is more coherent about all this stuff than any candidate. Like, he understands where we're headed, which is why he advocates for universal basic income, which is, he's not just a one-note candidate, but he talks about that the most because he's the only candidate talking about it at all. So he has to explain it a lot of like why it's not insane to offer up a universal basic income.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he would be helpful to her, because he wouldn't just be seen as, oh, here's someone for the feminists to get behind because it's a female candidate.
Problem with him, though, is that you get a guy that's not only a technocrat but is Asian, and so if you're concerned about people looking at it as kind of the identity politics ticket, then, you know, you really get that with him. Although,
but he's like, it's weird, he's one of these people that, because he's a centrist and like technically got into the Democratic debates but could easily have been an independent or even a Republican candidate, a lot of it has to do with just him drawing a different crowd. I mean, he has the feel of the you know, Bernie could have defeated Trump 4 years ago because he would have accessed a lot of these disaffected independent voters. And I don't think that Warren appeals to them in the same way that Bernie would have. I'm not saying that Bernie's the choice this time around, because I agree with your assessment of him this time, but I think you need something to get the independents and the libertarians who don't like Donald Trump personally, but also don't mind his economic politics, to someone with a robust understanding of a modern economy to be alongside with her.
I would normally agree with that, except that I think that Andrew Yang doesn't get you that crew. Mostly because I think the very clear and definitive overwhelming base of Trump is basically racists who are glad that someone gets to say what they've been thinking for all, you know, all the time. And so the very small percentage,
but it's also, there's also a lot of factory workers. It's a lot of people who've had their lives ruined for economic reasons because they worked 30 years in a plant and the plant closed down and they got left behind and nobody did anything and they got addicted to, you know, opiates, and that's where they're at. And these people voted for Trump because they felt like whoever was running, it happened to be Hillary Clinton at the time, but whoever represented the institution of the government had abandoned them, didn't care about them, didn't hear anything in her rhetoric to assume that she would care about them going forward. So Andrew Yang, may he not be the perfect person for this, but at least he's like, his UBI talk is all about everyone who's been dispossessed by the, you know, globalization, by automation. Like, that's,
I just don't think he's credible, though. I mean, I don't know if you saw him in the debate. I actually thought, you know, I mean, because I've heard a lot of people talk about him, but he was so unimpressive.
I agree.
As a speaker, he just died on the debate stage. He did not have any of the, I mean, his videos are kind of quirky. Like, I've seen a few of them, and he has kind of a personality, but he cannot bring it live. He was nervous and outmatched.
Well, also, like, the format, they gave him they gave him like 1/100th of the time allotted. No,
pulling at 1/100th of everybody else, though. That. I mean,
Castro also was not getting a lot of time, and Castro did the opposite. Castro, who I think should be Warren's running mate, was very impressive.
I completely agree with that, by the way. I think he'd be a tremendous VP candidate for her.
So,
I'm just saying, who's going to get the independents? The independents are going to swing the election.
I don't think they are. I think the independents are unicorns now. I don't think there are actual independents anymore. I think that everybody really is pretty much leaning one way or the other. And I think people that are likely to vote anyway of any type. And I think the running after the, you know, increasingly vanishingly small sliver that can't make up their minds and see that Donald Trump is an overwhelmingly different and evil person in comparison to anyone else running against him, that group of people is not going to get you over the finish line. I think the other thing about Warren, that, and I agree with you, I think your argument actually is a really good one, Russ, about the Pocahontas thing, with one problem, which is that because Trump is an absolute fucking moron, he has essentially undercut his own argument with this latest thing. Now, the reason that he's doing all this stuff with the going after AOC and the rest of the four congressmen is clearly because he's freaked out about Epstein. That's why. He's not doing this because he really is interested in getting even more racism on anybody else. It's because he's distracting because he's really freaked out about what they're going to find out about the stuff with Epstein. But regardless, it also has the side benefit of continuing to remind his base why they voted for him, because he's an asshole racist, and that's what they really wish they could be if they could wave their freak flag. The thing about what I think makes that problem good for Warren is that there's nothing, like, by the time, it's like pressing the same button over and over, right? And there's a certain point where gun sales, you may know, have plummeted. And part of the reason they plummeted is because, you know, you get, when you get a Democrat in office, and especially when you get a black Democrat in office, my God, you have to go buy out guns immediately because, you know, God knows that they're going to come and take your guns, even though it never actually happens. So when you get someone like this guy in office, you can't keep pressing the outrage button and going, oh, quick, go, better get more guns, right? The same thing happens to me on the race side, because at a certain point, you can't other, like, she's never going to be more other than the ones you've already othered. You've said, okay, the enemy is AOC and Tlaib and Presley and, right? Like, those are, that's the crew that you have to be afraid of. Now you bring out this woman who looks like your grandma and comes from Omaha and is a university professor and looks, even in the way that she acts, is as far from being, you know, looking woke as anyone that you could possibly get. And you can say Pocahontas all you want, but the people that you've already pissed off, and oh my God, have you pissed off the remaining moral independents, have been pushed utterly away from you with every action that Trump has taken. So you say Pocahontas a bunch, and that clearly reminds people of that threat of attack, which means you continue to lose that crew. You continue to lose the suburban mom who really doesn't like it when people are this cruel to not only women, but women of color. But you also
what is the newness to that attack? Like, what makes people go, oh? And so the only counter to that is, well, but they did it to Hillary by saying the same thing. But they had 3 decades of doing it to Hillary, so that it was so ingrained that that combined with Russian meddling, which was really got him elected, led to this result. That doesn't happen when you have this. There's not enough time to make Elizabeth Warren into a 3-decade-long Hillary Clinton.
But
and there's nothing novel about the attack anymore.
So your argument is that, I mean, from what you're saying, it seems to me that if Kamala Harris gets the nomination, then she wins. If Elizabeth Warren gets the nomination, then she wins. If Buttigieg gets the nomination,
no,
then she wins. If Bernie gets the nomination, then he wins. Like,
no, I wouldn't say that.
Why would anyone lose to Trump, given what you just said?
I wouldn't say that, because I do think that there are different concerns for each one. I think with Kamala Harris, I still haven't decided between her and Warren, because I like Harris for other reasons. But the problem with Harris is that I do think Harris reminds people a little bit of a sort of more forceful Obama. And there will be a lot of people who like that. But see, what I think they like about Obama is the fact that he was a class act and not a humiliating embarrassment. And he's not insane the way that Trump is. So if you get someone like that who's like Obama in that respect, that's great. But Kamala Harris doesn't bring you that, right? Kamala Harris is a lot more forceful. She's a former prosecutor. She's the kind of person who is likely to get people. She's someone that you're going to imagine as being someone who's going to fight hard for racial justice. Which, again, I don't necessarily think that. That certainly doesn't invalidate her, which is why I think she's certainly a very legitimate candidate. But she doesn't get, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I know a lot of people that think that Kamala Harris was in bed with a lot of the financial California types, is not going to move the ball down the field on climate change, is not really going to move the ball down the field on capitalist stuff that we've been talking about. So I don't think she fires up progressives in quite the same way.
Not at all.
As Warren would. And so that is sort of a problem with her. And Buttigieg, and I'm sorry, this is the thing about Buttigieg. I like him, but Buttigieg in the debate to me came off as glib. I think Buttigieg comes across as a guy who is the mayor of the third largest town in Indiana. And I don't think that a guy like that, despite the fact that he has the attractive profile of being in the military, which for some reason has got to make us think that he's better than others, although I don't know why, but anyway, and because he speaks a bunch of different languages and he's clearly smart, people think, okay, well, this is the guy for us. I'm not convinced that that guy moves the needle on enough things. I think if you want to run him for Senate in Indiana, sure. But I think if you're going to run him for president, I don't know that we're there as a presidential candidate. I also think that Buttigieg would not be a bad VP pick for Warren either, because I think that he is a far more fascinating figure than someone like Pence. And so you can imagine Warren just beating the floor with Trump, and Pence, who has the charisma of warm oatmeal, collapsing in front of Buttigieg, who is nice like Pence, but 10 times more intelligent and far more charismatic. So I do think that Buttigieg is good for that, but as a main leader role, I don't know. And as we've already said, Bernie's too old. So I think, and I think he's too set in his ways. And, you know, so I think if you put all that together, I do think that there are unique characteristics to Warren. The other thing is too, just Warren is just, as I said, she's gotten better as a candidate. Like, I feel like I was not crazy about her as a potential candidate in 2016, because I didn't think she was that good at retail campaigning in Massachusetts either. But she is clearly better at that now. If you see the stump speeches, if you see the stuff that she is capable of delivering real excitement and buzz. And the only real issue is, can she bring enough people of color along? And the thing about that is, people of color, especially the African-American community, are way more practical and intelligent voters than most of the white voters are. So what they do is they wait and they go, oh, you have a legitimate chance of winning because we really need to beat Trump. We will then vote for you. It's exactly what happened with Obama in 2008. Most people were not on Obama's side until they saw how he did in Iowa. And they're like, oh, you do have a shot. And then they all came to him, but they didn't do that initially. They did it based upon the fact that they thought he could win. And I think that Warren, if she can prove that she can win, will get those on her side. And at that point, I think she's formidable. I think if all you can throw her is Pocahontas and university professor, I don't see how that sustains someone with all of his incredible unfavorables. I don't see how that sustains him in an election. And by the way, if the economy even slightly shifts downwards, now I agree with Story's overall point he's been making for many years that the economy is way worse than people think it is anyway, but whatever. If the economy shifts even slightly, right, in the direction of, oh my God, we're in big trouble, Warren wins that in a walk, because of all the candidates, she is the only one who very clearly people would be like, okay, she understands the economy and that's what we need right now. So I feel like she's good anyway. And if the economy ever becomes a factor, which it could very well do, I think Warren is clearly your best option of the group that's there. So I think she's got a lot of unique. In fact, I think I've convinced myself to move her up to number two on my list now, actually. And maybe she is better than Harris. But anyway, yeah. And she was clearly better. By the way, Story's point was 100% right. Like, so Harris definitely won day two of the debates. But Warren was, not only did Warren win day one of the debates, it was like nobody even got in her way. She was just like, nobody interrupted her. You know, she's just like, all right, I'm going to just show you why this is the case. And everyone's like, yeah, you're right. This is the case.
Well, the moderators kept trying to ask everyone else to draw contrast. And they're like, no, no, no. Like people who are like corporatist and don't agree with her at all. We're like, no, no, no. I agree with Warren on this.
Right. Great. Exactly.
You know, nobody wanted to be, I mean, I am more concerned about the Pocahontas thing than you are. Like, I think that is her one weakness.
I agree. Oh, I think it has play, but not as much play as you might think.
Without that. And I, you know, I am concerned about it in part because it corrodes her credibility among people. I mean, I had to think long and hard because the way she handled that, and not initially, but the way she handled that this year was so atrocious. And, you know, and I was a huge advocate of her in 2016. I think she would have crushed Hillary and I think she would have crushed Trump. And I think, you know, the world is poorer for her decision not to run. But, you know, but it can still be made up for. But I mean, she did a deplorable job of handling the identity thing and whatever else. And that will be a bit of an issue. That said, I think that, you know, very few people are going to use that as a reason to favor Trump.
In the end, I just don't think it moves the needle enough. You know, how could you be this?
Like, okay, well, therefore we're going to do Trump. I mean,
right.
It could be a reason for some people to stay home. I don't think it's that many people, but I don't think there's a lot of independence. And I certainly don't think the election is going to swing on independence. I think the election is going to swings on
base,
who turns a lot of people out. And gets
no question. And don't you see, you know, thinking about the starry eyed thing for a minute, Story.
Yeah.
Don't you just see her going into the towns, like the mining towns surrounding Pittsburgh, right? Mm-hmm. And like the old steel towns, I should say, at right. The place that used to be this way.
Sure.
I feel like she just goes into those rooms. She swings people because of her own personal story, because she comes from essentially that's where she was from, essentially. Right. Like that's what that was like for her, where she grew up. And like, I just feel like, and those states turned on such small percentages that and he's already way underwater as it is, Trump is in those states. She goes back and she wins Michigan, and I think she would. She wins Pennsylvania, and I think she would. Right. He's in enormous trouble. The hell with Florida and Ohio and all those things. He's in huge trouble. And that's before you even think about, you know, Virginia, which just keeps getting farther away from the Republicans, Arizona, right, which is starting to move in that direction. North Carolina is not far off. You know, that's assuming that nothing else happens. He's in huge trouble if he loses those states. And I feel like with these others, I don't know, does Buttigieg move into those places and move the needle? I don't know.
I mean, I do think there's a little bit of an X factor there with the economy. Like, I think that if the economy is essentially like it is now for the quote unquote little guy, then yeah, absolutely. I think if the economy gets better for the common person, which I don't know why it would.
I was going to say, I don't see how.
But if there's a perceptual reality, because perceptual reality matters way more than real reality.
Sure.
And these kinds of things, like even if there's a perceptual reality that things are better or on the verge of getting better for the so-called common person, I do think that Trump becomes a lot more formidable against anyone, but especially an Elizabeth Warren, because, you know, her way of boxing out Trump is being a sincere populist. I agree with you completely that I think she goes into the Rust Belt and is like, I actually live this. And by the way, like, Trump did not deliver on his promises. Like, he said he was going to drain the swamp, and what he brought you was, you know, a bunch of Goldman Sachs people in high office, and the same revolving door that's always been there. So,
yep.
You know, so I think she can call him out on that, and I think you know, the Pocahontas thing is like a little bit of a knock to her credibility, but unless he can paint her to be as much of an oligarch as Hillary was, like, I don't think it's going to work. But if, you know, if Happy Days are here again, and it seems like that, and that's kind of the sentiment abroad in the land, then I do think Trump is pretty formidable for anyone to beat, because unfortunately the economy, even though the president doesn't have much control over it, is a lot of what determines.
Yeah, for sure. It just seems so unlikely that that's going to happen. Like,
I agree.
If anything, it's going to get worse. It's hard to see it getting better for the blue guy, you know?
I think that's more likely, yeah.
So the other thing
that's... And then the Epstein thing, yeah. I mean, the Epstein thing is hanging out there too. I mean, I don't... Who knows, you know, but...
I think he's very afraid of it.
I think it's possible that... I mean, it seems increasingly likely that Epstein's lived his entire life by just... getting, you know, ridiculous dirt on extremely powerful people. And, you know, it's possible that Trump and Bill Clinton both go to jail over this. So,
which by the way, I thought it was funny because the reaction for people was just like, well, what if they take in Bill Clinton? I'm like, then enjoy jail, Bill, because the idea that Democrats give a goddamn if Bill Clinton goes to jail is ludicrous. Like, obviously, if you're a Democrat of a certain grade, you're like, you know, you probably have good feelings for Bill Clinton. You're certainly not going to be like, well, all right, you're right, we need to make sure that Bill Clinton stays out of jail. Let's go to hell. I mean, if he's involved with this in any respect, all of them should rot. All of them should rot. I don't care who they are. Barack Obama is my favorite politician of the 20th that I've ever had the honor of voting for twice. If Barack Obama was involved with it, send the guy to jail. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. If there was anyone like that, like, I just don't, this idea, this gotcha idea that, like, you know, but then better be careful because they'll go after your guy. I'm like, he's not my guy if he was doing this, you know? So, right. I mean,
a lot of Democrats disagree with you, but I appreciate
fewer than you think. I think
you are principled. There are a lot of people who are in love with Bill Clinton for life. And, you know, I mean, as is evident
from jail as a child rapist, you know, like, I don't see it.
I don't know.
Child rapist is a line most of them won't cross. There's some that will, but not many. Most of them are like, they'll forgive him his foibles. They'll say he had, you know, bad impulse control, blah, 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 blah. But they won't go with him being a child rapist. The Republicans will, because the Republicans now are left are a death cult. But the rest, the Democrats are, for whatever your problems with them, they are not a death cult. And most of them will not go along with child rapist. That does not have a good ring to it, like whoever you are. And especially because, and I hate to say this, many of those will be pretty little white girls, and that's going to bother them even more. You know what I mean? Like the famous, like, why is it that we pay so much attention to the little girl who gets lost? And you used to talk about this story, and mm-hmm. it's like, yeah. Because the poor little white girl, those are the people that they were bringing over, and the poor little white girl being raped, they are not going to want to hear that in the least. I think that's why he's so afraid of it, because I think Trump knows very well what Epstein's got. Now, of course, who knows? Who knows what's going to come out? Who knows whatever? But there's got to be a reason that he's gone off on this complete, you know, like complete thing. And that, and the fact that it sort of riles up his base. But it, to me, it is distract, distract, distract. And it's up to us in the alternative media to keep our eyes on the ball. And the reason I bring up alternative media is because we're actually over an hour, guys. We have spent all of our time talking about politics, Facebook coin. I guess this was not, I can't say, dear audience, that this was one of our funnier episodes, but every so often we've got to, you know, we're a think tank here at the Mep Report, and we got to think and tank with all of you sometimes, you know? So that's what we did this time. So,
We mostly tanked.
Yeah, that's mostly what happened. We hope you like what you heard today. If you did, we hope that you will follow us over at themepreport.com and spread the word. You may notice that we were just talking about this. We are back to being a little more active. You know, we've gotten, actually, we will have 5 shows in about 6 months, which is, you know, that's a show a month is, you know, we're picking up the pace again, maybe a little bit. And so we're getting there. And that's our goal, basically, is to outrun the amount of time that it takes for Russ to have a third child. So if we can just, you know, we can just do that.
Could happen any day.
I forgot to tell you guys, actually. Never know already. We have a third arrival, but thank you for listening, and we will catch all of you lovely folks very soon. Until then, be good, everybody. Say goodbye, everybody.
Well, the last time I saw
say goodbye. Elizabeth Warren. Bye. 2019.
She can't fly, but I'm telling you, she can run the pace of a kangaroo. She can't fly, but I'm telling you, she can run the pace of a kangaroo. Well, there is a moral to this ditty, Thrush can sing, but he ain't pretty, Duck can swim, but he can't sing, nor can the eagle on the wing. Emu can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can round the fence of a kangaroo. Well, the kookaburra laughed and he said, it's true,